live a life that would have made his mother proud. By middle school, Kayvon was ranked as one of the best trombone players in his district. But when he started high school, he was bullied. As one of the shortest boys in his grade, he was an easy target. Upperclassmen beat him up, made fun of him in the hallways, and spread rumors about him. When he rapped at a pep rally, they booed him off the stage. When the next freshman class entered, Kayvon found the strength to stand up for himself and others. He welcomed the new students and offered support to those who were being bullied. He shared his rap music with them. By his senior year, many students knew his songs by heart. He was elected student body president and graduated as valedictorian. "Music taught me how to bounce back from challenges more than anything else in this world," Kayvon told us. "Whether it's the tragedy that tore my family apart, or being bullied, or something as silly as a high school breakup, it channeled my energy into something positive. Music transforms the darkness." Like their students, teachers benefit from a growth mindset. Since the 1960s, researchers have demonstrated that when teachers are told students from stigmatized groups have potential to bloom, the teachers begin to treat them differently. They help students learn from failure. They set high expectations, give students extra attention, and actively encourage them to develop their strengths. This can help students believe in themselves and work harder, earning higher grades. With the right support, beliefs can fuel action and become self-fulfilling. Believe you can learn from failure and you become less defensive and more open. Believe you matter and you spend more time helping others, which helps you matter even more. Believe you have strengths and you start seeing opportunities to use them. Believe you are a wizard who can cross the space-time continuum and you may have gone too far. When kids face trauma, the beliefs that help build resilience become even more critical. More than 1.8 million children in America have lost a parent, and in a national poll, nearly three-quarters said their lives would have been much better if their parent had survived. When asked whether they would trade a year of their lives for just one more day with their late mother or father, more than half said yes. In our house, we know that feeling well. My kids were heartbroken. I was heartbroken. And I was heartbroken that they were heartbroken. But even in those dark hours when my children first learned that their lives had changed forever, there were glimpses of light. My son stopped crying for a moment to thank me for coming home to be with him when he found out, and to thank my sister and parents for being there too. Amazing. Later that night, when I was putting my daughter to bed, she said, "I am not only sad for us, Mommy. I am sad for Grandma Paula and Uncle Rob because they lost him too." Amazing. I remembered how the night Mindy's mom died. She asked me to sleep over, but then worried that our other friends would feel left out. Even in the worst moments of their lives, my kids, like Mindy, had the capacity to think of others. And that gave me hope. A few days later, my kids and I sat down with a big piece of paper and colored markers. Over the years, we had hung signs and schedules over their backpack cubbies. Carol had explained that giving kids a sense of stability was essential at a time when their world is turned upside down. I thought it might help to create family rules, which we could put on the wall to remind us of the coping mechanisms we would need. We sat down to write them out together. Family rules. 1. Respect our feelings. Sad moments, break. It's okay to be jealous. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to be happy. It's okay to laugh. It's okay to ask for help. Don't blame yourself. We did not deserve this. I'd rather not talk about it now. 2. Sleep. Go to bed on time. Rest in bed. Meditation. No iPad before 7. Don't worry if you can't fall asleep. Ask for help. 3. Forgiveness. Double sorry. Mirroring. Forgive yourself. Forgive others. Ask for help. 4. Teamwork. There's no I in team. We get through this together. Ask for help. Ask any question. Say anything. I wanted them to know that they should respect their feelings and not try to suppress them. We wrote together that it's okay to be sad, and they could take breaks from any activity to cry. That it's okay to be angry and jealous of their friends and cousins who still had fathers. That it's okay to say to anyone that they did not want to talk about it now. That they should know we did not deserve this. I wanted to make sure guilt did not cloud any moment when my kids could have a break from grief. So we agreed that it was okay to be happy and to laugh. People often marvel at how resilient kids can be. There are neurological reasons for this. Kids have more neural plasticity than adults, allowing their brains to adapt more easily in the face of stress. I learned from Carol that children have limits to how much intense emotion they can process at once. They have shorter feeling spans. Their grief comes more in bursts than in sustained periods. Kids also sometimes express their grief through behavior changes and play rather than in words. As Carol told me to expect, my children cycled in and out of grief very quickly, sobbing one moment and then running off to play the next. I realized sleep would be important to help us get through this. When I was a child, my parents always emphasized sleep, which I thought was no fun at all. Once I had my own children, I understood how right they were. When we're tired, we're physically and mentally weaker, more likely to be irritable, and we literally lack the energy to feel joy. Sleep matters even more in adversity because we need to marshal all our strength, so I stuck as close as I could to their regular bedtimes. When my kids had trouble falling asleep, I tried to teach them to count 6 breaths in and out, just as my mom had taught me. Since our feelings were extremely raw, I knew we would make many mistakes, so forgiveness became a huge theme. The year before, my daughter and I had attended a girls' leadership workshop and learned about fast double sorries. When two people hurt each other's feelings, you both apologize quickly so that you forgive each other and yourselves. Feeling deep grief and anger meant we all got upset much more easily, so we relied on this strategy a lot. When we lost control of our emotions, we would say we were sorry right away. Then we would mirror each other. The first person would explain what was upsetting, and the second person would repeat it back and apologize. We were trying to show that the other person's feelings mattered to us. At one point, my daughter cried out, "I'm upset because both of you got more years with Daddy than I did." My son and I acknowledged that it was unfair that she'd had the least time. I tried to help my children be kind to themselves, to not beat themselves up for being angry at each other, for being jealous of other kids and even me because I still had a father. I came to see teaching them self-compassion as part of nurturing a growth mindset. When they didn't dwell on yesterday's grief, they could approach today as a new day. We vowed to do this, like everything else, as a team. It didn't always work as planned. Long before Dave died, I had learned that parenting was the most humbling job in the world. And now I had to relearn how to do it alone. My kids were struggling with their emotions, and so was I, which made even the most basic decisions hard. Dave and I were always strict about bedtimes. But do you put an exhausted child to bed on time when he is crying for his lost father? When small issues become big fights, do you hold children to the same behavioral standards as before, Or do you overlook these outbursts because you feel that same anger? And if you let things slide too much, will the kids act out with their friends who are not old enough to understand and forgive? I wavered back and forth and made a lot of mistakes. A lot. Once again, I was so grateful for my friends and family. I relied on my mom and her friend Merle for parenting advice and tried to follow their suggestions. Say things once. Stay calm. Sometimes, no matter how carefully I planned how to handle a situation, I failed. One day, my daughter refused to leave the house for a group hike with Marnie, Phil, Mark, and Priscilla. While the others waited outside, I tried to convince her that she'd have fun, but she wouldn't budge. Literally. She sat down on the floor, and I couldn't get her to move. I believe the clinical term is super frustrated. Phil came in to check on our progress and found the two of us sitting on the floor sobbing. With humor, he cajoled my daughter into getting back on her feet and joining the group. Priscilla cajoled me into doing the same. A short time later, after double sorries, my daughter was running up a hiking path smiling. The family rules still hang above the kids' cubbies, but only recently did I notice that asking for help is in all four categories. Now I see that this is at the heart of building resilience. When children feel comfortable asking for help, they know they matter. They see that others care and want to be there for them. They understand that they are not alone and can gain some control by reaching out for support. They realize that pain is not permanent. Things can get better. Carol helped me understand that even when I felt helpless because I could not fix or cure my children's grief, if I could walk alongside them and listen, what she called companioning, I would be helping them. As I wrestled with my own emotions, I worried about how much of my grief to show my children. For the first few months, we were all crying constantly. One day, my son told me it made him sad when I cried. So I began holding back my tears, running up to my bedroom and closing the door when I felt them well up. Initially, it seemed to help. But a few days later, my son asked me in anger, "Why don't you miss Daddy anymore?" By protecting him from my tears, I had stopped modeling the behavior I wanted from him. I apologized for hiding my emotions and started letting him see them again. Since the day Dave died, I have continued to talk about him. It's not always easy to do, and I've watched adults flinch, as if it's too painful for them to be reminded. But I have a deep desire to keep Dave's memory alive. And when I mention him, he remains present. Because our children were so young, I realize, and this completely breaks my heart, that their memories of their father will fade. So it's up to me to make sure they know him. A friend of mine who lost her father when she was 6 years old told me that she has spent her adult life trying to piece together who he really was. So I asked dozens of Dave's closest family members, friends, and colleagues to capture their memories of him on video. My daughter and son will never have another conversation with their father, but one day, when they are ready, they will learn about him from those who loved him. I also taped my children sharing their own memories so that as they grow up, they will know which memories of him are truly theirs. This past Thanksgiving, my daughter was distraught, and when I got her to open up, she told me, "I'm forgetting Daddy because I haven't seen him for so long." I showed her a video of her talking about him, and it helped. When children grow up with a strong understanding of their family's history, where their grandparents grew up, what their parents' childhoods were like, they have better coping skills and a stronger sense of belonging. Talking openly about positive and even difficult memories can help develop resilience. It's especially powerful to share stories about how the family sticks together through good times and bad, which allows kids to feel that they are connected to something larger than themselves. Just as journaling can help adults process adversity, these discussions help children make sense of their past and embrace challenges. Giving all members of the family a chance to tell their stories builds self-esteem, particularly for girls. And making sure to integrate different perspectives into a coherent story builds a sense of control, particularly for boys. A friend who lost his mother when he was young told me that over time, she no longer seemed real. People either were afraid to mention his mom or spoke of her in idealized terms. I try to hold on to Dave as he really was. Loving, generous, brilliant, funny, and also pretty clumsy. He would spill things constantly and was always shocked when he did. Now, when emotions are swirling yet my son stays calm, I tell him, "You are just like your daddy." When my daughter stands up for a classmate who is getting picked on, I say, "Just like your daddy." And when either of them knocks a glass over, I say it too. Parents often worry that these conversations will make their children sad. But research on nostalgia suggests the opposite. Nostalgia comes from the Greek words nostos and algos, which mean return and pain. Nostalgia is literally the suffering that we feel when we yearn for the past to come back to us. Yet psychologists find that it is mostly a pleasant state. After people reflect on an event, they tend to feel happier and more connected to others. They often find life more meaningful and become inspired to create a better future. Rather than ignoring painful milestones from the past, we try to mark them in the present. My friend Devin Spurgeon lost her father young and gave me a wonderful idea for what would have been Dave's 48th birthday. My kids and I wrote letters to Dave and sent them up in balloons. I've noticed that when people tell stories about Dave, my son and daughter are usually comforted. My brother-in-law Mark has told them Dave had a happy energy and shared it generously. It's hard to imagine your dad having a good time without lots of other people joining in. Phil often comments to our kids that Dave didn't brag or exaggerate, but spoke to others thoughtfully and with care. We all wish that they had Dave to show them how to be happy and humble by his example. Instead, we are trying to make the most of option B. Adam told me about a program at Arizona State University that helps children recover after losing parents. One of its key steps is to create a new family identity so kids feel that the people left make a complete unit. Looking back at the photos of the three of us taken even in those first weeks and months, I was surprised to see that we did have some moments of happiness. Like when my son and daughter played tag with friends. Photos are important because happiness is remembered, not just experienced. And losing Dave taught me how precious video is. When I see photos of him, I long to see him move and hear him speak. Now I take videos as much as possible. My kids used to duck whenever I began recording them. But since they started watching these clips to remember their father, they smile and talk to the camera. The Arizona State program also recommends setting aside time for the new family unit to have fun together. It gives kids a break from grief and helps them feel like they're part of a whole family again. The activity can't be passive like watching TV. It has to be something active, like playing board games or cooking together. We call it FAF, which is short for Family Awesome Fun. My son offered to let my daughter choose the first activity, and FAF became a weekly tradition we stuck to for more than a year. We also created a family cheer where we link arms and shout, "We are strong!" The three of us are still adjusting to being just the three of us. There are still plenty of fast double sorries as we continue to cope and learn and make mistakes and grow. As individuals, we feel weaker on some days than on others. but as a family, we are stronger together. Nearly a year after Dave died, I attended my son's music concert at school one afternoon. As hard as I try not to be jealous of others, seeing all the fathers watching their children was a stark reminder of what my children and I lost, and what Dave lost. As soon as I got home, I ran upstairs in tears. Unfortunately, my workday wasn't over. I had to host the annual dinner for Facebook's largest clients from around the world. As people started arriving, I still couldn't pull myself together. My son was with me, and I told him that I needed to stop crying and go downstairs. He held my hand and said, "You should just go, and it's okay if you're crying. Everyone knows what happened to us." Then he added, "Mom, they probably have things they cry about too, so you should just be yourself." He was teaching me what I had tried to teach him. Chapter 8, Finding Strength Together. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Martin Luther King, Jr. In 1972, a plane flying from Uruguay to Chile crashed into a mountain in the Andes, split in half, and barreled down a snowy slope. For the 33 survivors, this was just the beginning of an extraordinary ordeal. Over the next 72 days, the group battled shock, frostbite, avalanches, and starvation. Only 16 of them made it out. Alive. Thanks to the popular book and movie, many of us know the extreme measures taken by the group in order to survive. New analysis by Spencer Harrison, a researcher, mountain climber, and colleague of Adams, explains not just how these men survived, but why. Spencer tracked down four of the survivors, combed through their journals, and even visited the crash site with one of them. Every survivor's story shared a common theme. A key to their resilience was hope. Most of the 45 people on board were rugby players in their late teens and early 20s, traveling to an exhibition match. Damage to the plane's radio meant they could not send communications, but they could still receive them. Their first plan was to wait for rescue in the shelter of the plane. We all believed that rescue was our only chance of survival. Nando Parado wrote, and we clung to that hope with an almost religious zeal. 9 days later, their supplies were depleted. The group was forced to turn to their only remaining source of food, the flesh from the frozen bodies of their teammates who had died. The next morning, a few of the passengers heard over the radio that the search had been called off. "We mustn't tell them," said the team captain. "At least let them go on hoping." Another passenger, Gustavo Nikolic, disagreed. "Good news," he shouted. "We're going to get out of here on our own." We normally think of hope as something individuals hold in their heads and in their hearts. But people can build hope together. By creating a shared identity, individuals can form a group that has a past and a brighter future. Some people say, if there's life, there's hope, survivor Roberto Canessa explained. But for us, it was the opposite. If there's hope, there's life. During long, cold, and hungry days, the crash survivors prayed together. They planned projects to launch after returning to civilization. One passenger spoke of opening a restaurant. Another dreamed of having a farm. Each night, two of the survivors looked at the moon and imagined that right then their parents were looking at the same moon. Another took pictures to record their plight. Many wrote letters to their families declaring their will to survive. To maintain faith at all times, despite our setbacks, we had to become alchemists. Survivor Javier Metol said, changing tragedy into a miracle, depression into hope. Of course, hope by itself isn't enough. Many of the passengers had hope, yet still lost their lives. But hope keeps people from giving in to despair. Researchers find that hope springs up and persists when communities of people generate new images of possibility. Believing in new possibilities helps people fight back against the idea of permanence and propels them to seek out new options. They find the will and the way to move forward. Psychologists call this grounded hope, the understanding that if you take action, you can make things better. I never stopped praying for the arrival of our rescuers or for the intercession of God, Parado recalled. But at the same time, the cold-blooded voice that had urged me to save my tears was always whispering in the back of my mind, "No one will find us. We will die here. We must make a plan. We must save ourselves." Parado and Canessa set out on a trek with a third survivor and nearly froze to death before locating the tail of the plane, which contained insulation that they turned into a sleeping bag. Nearly 2 months after the crash, this makeshift sleeping bag allowed Parado and Canessa to launch another expedition. They hiked 33 miles across treacherous terrain, scaling a 14,000-foot peak. After 10 days, they spotted a man on horseback. The 14 other survivors were rescued by helicopter. The community formed by the alive survivors has stayed close for decades. Each year they gather on the anniversary of their rescue to play rugby. Together they contributed to a book about their experience, La Sociedad de la Nieve, the Snow Society. And in 2010, when 33 miners were trapped underground in Chile, four of the Andes survivors flew in from Uruguay to address the miners by video. "We've come to give them a little faith and hope," Gustavo Servino said at the time, "to say we're at their service if they need us for anything, and above all, to give support to the families outside." After 69 days, the first miner was lifted to the surface in a capsule while hundreds cheered. It took a full day, but all 33 miners were rescued and reunited with their loved ones. The tent city where everyone gathered above the mine was called Campamento Esperanza, Camp Hope. Resilience is not just built in individuals. It is built among individuals, in our neighborhoods, schools, towns, and governments. When we build resilience together, we become stronger ourselves and form communities that can overcome obstacles and prevent adversity. Collective resilience requires more than just shared hope. It is also fueled by shared experiences, shared narratives, and shared power. For my children and me, getting to know people who also lost a parent or a spouse has provided much-needed comfort. In most religions and cultures, traditions around mourning are communal. We come together to bury and remember those we have lost. At first, our house was filled with friends and family who made sure we had support around the clock. But eventually, our loved ones needed to get back to their normal routines, and we needed to find a new normal routine. And the loneliness hit hard. In my second week of widowhood, I had put my kids to bed and was sitting alone in my kitchen when I flashed forward to an image I'd never thought of before. A much older version of myself, sitting at that same table in front of a Scrabble board. But instead of Dave sitting across from me, I was staring at an empty chair. That week, my kids and I went to CARA, a local grief support center. Meeting other people who were farther along in the same journey helped us overcome permanence by showing us that we wouldn't be stuck in the void of acute grief forever. When we suffer loss or face difficulties of any kind, there is a real desire deep in most people for human connection, explained CARA's executive director, Jim Santucci, who himself lost a child. Support groups connect you with others who really get what you're going through. Deep human connection. It's not just, "Oh, I feel bad for you," but "I actually understand." My kids also attended experience camps, a free week-long program for children who have lost a parent, sibling, or primary caregiver. Two of the core values at the camp are building community and inspiring hope. In one exercise, kids went to stations to confront an emotion associated with grieving. For anger, kids used chalk to scrawl words that made them angry on the pavement. Some wrote bullying, others wrote cancer or drugs. Then on the count of three, they threw water balloons on the ground to smear the words away and release their anger. At a second station, a camper held a brick representing guilt. As the brick became too heavy, another camper shared the burden of its weight. These exercises helped show my children that their emotions were normal, and other kids felt them too. To join a community after tragedy, we often have to accept our new, and often unwelcome, identity. Writer Alan Rucker told us that after he became paralyzed, "I initially didn't want to hang around people who were in wheelchairs. I didn't want to belong to that club. I saw myself as a freak. I didn't want to join the freak fraternity." His mind didn't change overnight. It took 4 or 5 years. It almost felt like every cell in my brain had to transfer one at a time, very slowly learning to accept this thing. As he made this personal adjustment, he grew closer to those who understood his situation. The bonus, he told us, was, "These are some of the funniest people I have ever met because their humor is just as dark as possible." Alan's point struck a deep chord within me. It took me a long time to say the word widow, and to this day it makes me wince. Still, I am a widow, and accepting this identity allowed me to form new friendships. In the past 2 years, all of the new friends I've made have lived through tragedy. The first time I wrote that sentence, it said, "Most have lived through tragedy." But then I realized it was literally all of them. The club that no one wants to belong to is incredibly bonding. Perhaps because none of us wanted to join, we cling to one another. When Stephen Sifra arrived at the University of California, Berkeley, he felt like an outsider. And not just because at 38, he was twice as old as a typical freshman. Growing up, Stephen suffered physical abuse and started smoking crack at age 10. Burglaries and carjacking led to stints in juvenile hall and then state prison. After fighting with another inmate and spitting on a guard, Stephen was sent to solitary confinement for 4 years. He has since testified to the California State Legislature that isolation is a torture chamber. After his release from prison, Stephen entered a 12-step program, completed his GED, and met his partner, Sylvia. He discovered a love of English literature, and after several years at community college, he was accepted to Berkeley. He'd earned his spot, but once he got to campus, he felt different and disconnected. "I went to the English classes, but I didn't really see myself in the faces of the people there," he said. Then one day, Stephen was walking through the Center for Transfer Students and was stopped by Danny Murillo, another student in his 30s, who said he instantly recognized Stephen's demeanor. Within a minute, they realized that they'd both spent time in solitary at Pelican Bay State Prison. "What happened in that moment," Stephen said, "is I saw myself as a student at Cal with every privilege and every right to be there." Stephen and Danny became close friends and united to speak out against the cruelty of solitary confinement. They also helped start the Underground Scholars Initiative, a group that supports Berkeley students affected by incarceration. Having experienced the deepest desolation, they wanted to come together as a community. "As a collective of students, we wanted to put each other in the best possible position to succeed," Danny told us. "A lot of times, formerly incarcerated people don't want to ask for help. We're trying to get them to understand that it's actually a sign of strength to recognize when you don't have the skills to do something and reach out for help. Wanting to improve is not a sign of weakness." The Posse Foundation is another organization founded on the importance of grouping students with similar backgrounds to combat feelings of isolation. Posse took its name from a remark made by a talented but lonely former student who observed, "If only I had my posse with me, I never would have dropped out." Posse recruits underprivileged high schoolers who have demonstrated extraordinary academic and leadership potential and sends them in teams of 10 to attend the same college on scholarship. Since 1989, Posse has helped nearly 7,000 students attend college with a 90% graduation rate. If we are serious about creating ladders of opportunity for everyone, we need to provide greater public and private support for long-term intensive efforts like Posse. Along with shared hope and experiences, shared narratives can build collective resilience. Narratives might sound light. How important can a story be? But they are how we explain our past and set expectations for our future. Just as family stories help children feel a sense of belonging, collective stories create identity for communities. And stories that emphasize values like equality are critical for pursuing justice. Shared stories are often created by rewriting old narratives and countering unfair stereotypes. In the United States and around the world, girls are often expected to be worse at math than boys. When college students were reminded of their gender before taking a math test, women performed 43% worse than men. When the exact same test was called a problem-solving test instead of a math test, the gender gap in performance vanished. In another experiment, black students scored lower than white students after being told that a test would assess their verbal ability. But when ability wasn't mentioned, the race gap in performance disappeared. Psychologists call this stereotype threat, the fear of being reduced to a negative stereotype. That fear becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy when anxiety disrupts our thinking and causes us to conform to the stereotype. This effect undermines people of many races, religions, genders, sexual orientations, and backgrounds. And this is where the Posse Foundation rewrites the narrative. When Posse students arrive at college together, they create a different image on campus. In the words of one Posse alum, "The buzz around the school is that these Posse kids are cool and smart." Instead of being threatened by negative stereotypes, they are lifted by positive ones. I gained a new appreciation for communities forming to change narratives years before when I was writing Lean In. As I began talking to women about reaching for their ambitions, one common reaction was, "I want to lean in, but how?" Women have less access to the mentorship and sponsorship that are key to success in the workplace. But peer support can have a big impact. I teamed up with three women who were passionate about peer mentorship: Rachel Thomas, Gina Bianchini, and Debbie Hemeter, to launch Lean In Circles, small groups of peers who meet regularly to support and encourage one another. Today, there are 32,000 circles in 150 countries. More than half of all members report that their circle helped them through a difficult time, and two-thirds say they are more likely to take on a new challenge after joining. I realize now that part of why circles help women reach for their individual goals is because they build collective resilience. The Millennial Latina Circle in East Palo Alto connects older women and teenagers with a group goal of helping the young women, many of whom are teen mothers, get into and graduate from college. The circle was founded by Guadalupe Valencia, who was forced to transfer to a different school after she became pregnant at 16. Many of the other adults in the group have personal and family histories of teen pregnancy too, and having seen its effects, they are determined to write a new story for the next generation. We all know what it is to live in a household where college is a word that is not even said, Guadalupe told me. But for the millennial Latinas, we are clear. College is not an option. College is a must. Guadalupe has become a role model for the members. Along with working full-time, she has followed her own mantra and gone back to school to finish her degree. Often the people fighting injustice are themselves the victims of injustice. They have to find the hope and strength to overcome the adversity they face today in order to work for improvements tomorrow. From the end of apartheid to the development of vaccines, some of the world's greatest achievements have been rooted in personal tragedies. By helping people cope with difficult circumstances and then take action to alter those circumstances, collective resilience can foster real social change. Some hardships result from centuries-old discrimination, the steady accumulation of injustice that threatens to crush even the most resilient among us. Others hit unexpectedly. When sudden violence strikes, it can shake our faith in humanity to its core. In these moments, it's hard to hold on to hope. Instead, we are justifiably filled with anger, frustration, and fear. That's why I was riveted when I read a Facebook post by journalist Antoine Larris, whose wife, Helene, was killed in a 2015 Paris terrorist attack. Just 2 days later, he wrote, "On Friday night, you stole the life of an exceptional being, the love of my life, the mother of my son. But you will not have my hate. I will not give you the satisfaction of hating you." He made a promise to defeat hate by not allowing it to affect his 17-month-old son. "We will play as we do every day, and all his life this little boy will defy you by being happy and free, because you will not have his hate either." When I started reading Antoine's post, I felt tremendous sorrow. But when I finished it, I was overcome by a tingling sensation in my chest and a lump in my throat. Adam told me there was a term for this. Psychologists have a term for everything. Moral elevation describes the feeling of being uplifted by an act of uncommon goodness. Elevation brings out what Abraham Lincoln called the better angels of our nature. Even in the face of atrocity, elevation leads us to look at our similarities instead of our differences. We see the potential for good in others and gain hope that we can survive and rebuild. We become inspired to express compassion and battle injustice. As Martin Luther King Jr. said, "Let no man pull you so low as to hate him." The month after Dave died, a white supremacist gunned down a senior pastor and 8 parishioners during their Wednesday Bible study at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. I was reeling from my own loss, and seeing such senseless violence sank me deeper into despair. Then I heard about the congregation's response. That week, relatives of the victims went to court to address the gunmen who had murdered their loved ones. One by one, they rejected his hatred. "You took something very precious away from me," said Nadine Collier, whose mother was killed. "I will never get to talk to her ever again. I will never be able to hold her again. But I forgive you and have mercy on your soul. You hurt me. You hurt a lot of people. If God forgives you, I forgive you." Instead of being consumed by hatred, the church members chose forgiveness, which allowed them to come together and stand against racism and violence. 4 days after the shooting, the church doors opened for regular Sunday service. 5 days later, President Barack Obama spoke at the funeral of Reverend Clemente C. Pinckney and led the congregation in singing "Amazing Grace." Mother Emmanuel, as the church is known, is the oldest African Methodist Episcopal church in the South. Its congregations have endured laws forbidding black worship, a white mob burning down their building, and an earthquake. After every tragedy, they came together to rebuild, sometimes literally and always emotionally. As Reverend Joseph Darby, the presiding elder for a neighboring district, told us, "Their extension of grace is rooted in a long-standing coping mechanism passed down from people who had no option in many cases but to forgive and move on while still leaving the door open for justice to be done. It takes you past raw vengeance. Forgiveness clears your head to pursue justice." On the Sunday after the 2015 shooting, church bells around the city tolled at 10 a.m. for 9 minutes, 1 minute for each victim. What unites us is stronger than what divides us, pronounced Jermaine Watkins, a pastor from a local church. To hatred, we say no way, not today. To racism, we say no way, not today. To division, we say no way, not today. To reconciliation, we say yes. To loss of hope, we say no way, not today. To a racial war, we say no way, not today. Charleston, together, we say no way, not today. As the community began picking up the pieces, area churches started hosting conferences on preventing violence. After the FBI determined that a system breakdown had allowed the shooter to purchase a gun, families who had been affected by gun violence joined forces with church and political leaders to advocate for more rigorous background checks. Social activism was not new to Charleston. Years before the shooting, religious leaders created the Charleston Area Justice Ministry, a network of 27 faith-based congregations, including churches, synagogues, and a mosque. Charleston did not have a tradition of houses of faith working together, Reverend Darby reflected. But some kind of divine serendipity kicked in. All of those people who would normally say, "This is not going to work," came to the table. Since then, each year the ministry chooses one problem to tackle, proposes solutions, and addresses the issue at a large assembly where thousands of citizens come together with political and religious leaders. One of the Justice Ministry's first accomplishments was convincing the school board to expand early childhood education by funding hundreds of additional preschool slots. Then they lobbied successfully to reduce juvenile incarceration and school suspensions. They were already helping disadvantaged communities, but after the shooting, the ministry's focus turned to preventing racial profiling. Before, they didn't talk about race, Reverend Darby told us. But after the Emmanuel tragedy, a light bulb went off in their heads. They realized they had to tackle race. It was fundamental to the challenges the community was facing. We can work to prevent violence and racism, but many forms of adversity can't be avoided. Loss, accidental injury, natural disasters. In 2010 alone, there were approximately 400 natural disasters worldwide that claimed about 300,000 lives and affected millions. Some of the responses to these disasters show us that shared hope, experiences, and narratives can light the spark of collective resilience. But for the fire to be sustained, we need shared power, the resources and authority to shape our own destiny. Resilient communities have strong social ties, bonds between people, bridges between groups, and links to local leaders. I observed the importance of these local ties when I worked at the World Bank on leprosy eradication in India decades ago. Because of historic stigma, leprosy patients often fail to seek treatment, allowing their disease to progress and spread to others. When health workers visited villages to identify people with leprosy, they were rebuffed. The local people did not trust these outsiders, and women especially were reluctant to show spots on their skin to strangers. The health workers needed to find another approach. They convinced village leaders to run early detection programs themselves. The leaders held community meetings and recruited local nonprofits and citizens to perform plays showing that anyone coming forward with early symptoms would not be ostracized, but would receive treatment and care. This work made me acutely aware that even the most heroic examples of individual resilience can be inadequate in the face of poverty and untreated illness. When people with leprosy were kicked out of their villages, no amount of individual resilience could have helped them. It was not until the community began treating leprosy patients rather than banishing them that people could recover and survive. Empowering communities builds collective resilience. After the 1994 genocide in Rwanda that killed hundreds of thousands of civilians, psychologists went to refugee camps in Tanzania to provide mental health care. They found that treating individuals was less effective than strengthening the community's ability to support vulnerable groups. The camps with the greatest resilience were organized like villages, with councils, meeting spaces for teenagers to hang out, soccer fields, entertainment venues, and places for worship. Instead of having outsiders in authority roles, the Rwandans led according to their cultural traditions. Self-organization provided order and built shared power. Other times, collective resilience is needed to fight unjust cultural traditions. In China, women who are single past the age of 27 are stigmatized as shengnu, or leftover women. They face severe pressure from their families to marry, stemming from the widespread belief that regardless of education and professional achievement, a woman is absolutely nothing until she is married. One 36-year-old economics professor was rejected by 15 men because she had an advanced degree. Her father then forbade her younger sister from going to graduate school. More than 80,000 women have joined lean-in circles in China, and they are working together to build shared power. One of the circles created the Leftover Monologues, a play where 15 women and 3 men take back the term leftover, while also speaking out against homophobia and date rape. Just a few months after Dave died, I met with 20 circle members from across China. In an effort to keep as many commitments as I could, I traveled to Beijing to speak at the Tsinghua University Business School commencement, bringing my parents and children with me. It was the first time I had spoken publicly since becoming a widow, and I was still in a fog. But spending time with these brave women right before the speech lifted my spirits. I had met with the same group 2 years earlier and was eager to hear about the progress they'd made. They talked about the compassion they felt for one another and for themselves. They spoke of changing careers and insisting to their parents that they were going to find their own life partners in their own time. And they spoke of action they were taking together that they never would have dared to take alone. I felt that tingling sensation in my chest and that lump in my throat. It was the best possible reminder that being part of a community can give us strength that we sometimes can't find on our own. We find our humanity, our will to live, and our ability to love in our connections to one another. Just as individuals can find post-traumatic growth and become stronger, so can communities. You never know when your community will need to call on that strength, but you can be sure that someday it will. When their plane crashed in the Andes, the rugby teammates had already built solidarity and trust. Early on, they looked to the team captain for guidance. When he didn't make it, they maintained confidence in one another. We all have our own personal Andes. Nando Parado wrote long after the expedition with Roberto Canessa that led to their rescue. Canessa added, "One of the things that was destroyed when we crashed into the mountain was our connection to society. But our ties to one another grew stronger every day." Chapter 9, Failing and Learning at Work. In a year filled with despair, one of the few highlights for me was watching a bunch of grown men cry. There were women crying too, but I had seen that more often. It was April 2016, and I was close to crossing the finish line on the year of firsts, with 3 dreaded milestones still to go. My son's first birthday without a father. My first wedding anniversary without a spouse. And a new unwelcome anniversary. The first anniversary of Dave's death. There were so many depressing firsts that I wanted to find a positive one for my kids. So I took them to Los Angeles to visit SpaceX's headquarters. After failing on 4 previous tries, SpaceX was attempting to land a rocket at sea. Our invitation came from Elon Musk, the company's CEO. The first time Elon and I crossed paths after Dave died, he told me how sorry he was and then added, "I understand how hard this is." In 2002, Elon's first child died suddenly at 2.5 months old. We did not say much more and just sat together, bonded by grief. On the day of the launch, my kids and I were on our feet along with a crowd of SpaceX employees in the company foyer. The countdown started on a large screen in front of us, and the rocket in Florida took off on time. Everyone cheered. The rocket's steering arms opened as planned. More cheers. Each time there was a visible success, SpaceX employees would high-five the team that had worked on that component, and then everyone would cheer together. As the rocket approached the drone ship to attempt the ocean landing, the tension in the room grew. The cheering stopped, and the crowd got very quiet. My heart was racing, and my daughter and son grasped my hands nervously. My daughter whispered to me, "I hope it doesn't blow up." I nodded, barely able to speak. As the rocket descended, three of the legs deployed, but one lagged behind, tipping the rocket off target. The whole room leaned to one side as if trying to correct the position. Then the rocket tilted back and landed safely. The room erupted like a rock concert. Support crew, technicians, and engineers screamed and hugged and cried. My kids and I cried too. I still get chills thinking about it. A few years ago, two management researchers became curious about what factors predict whether a spaceflight will succeed. Going back to the first launch of Sputnik 1 in 1957, they tracked every launch globally for nearly five decades across 30 organizations, mostly governments, but also some private companies. You might think the best odds of a successful launch would come after past success, but the data from more than 4,000 launches showed the exact opposite. The more times a government or company had failed, the more likely they were to put a rocket into orbit successfully on the next try. Also, their chances of success increased after a rocket exploded compared to a smaller failure. Not only do we learn more from failure than success, we learn more from bigger failures because we scrutinize them more closely. Long before the water landing, the first time SpaceX attempted a launch, the engine caught fire 33 seconds after ignition, and the rocket was destroyed. Elon had asked for the top 10 risks in advance of the launch, and the problem that caused the failure turned out to be number 11. Pro tip, ask for top 11 risks. The second launch failed for a relatively minor reason. The third launch would have succeeded if not for a tiny software bug. I had basically assumed that we would have money for three attempts, Elon reflected. When that third failure happened, I was just shredded. When my kids and I witnessed the successful water landing, the moment was even more meaningful because the triumph had followed so many disappointments. Just as all people need resilience, all organizations do too. We see it in the companies that kept going after losing hundreds of employees on September 11th. We see it in the businesses that rebound after financial crises and the nonprofits that regroup after losing donors. I saw it at the company Dave led, SurveyMonkey, when employees in the midst of grieving rallied around the hashtag #MakeDaveProud. When failures, mistakes, and tragedies happen, organizations make choices that affect the speed and strength of their recovery and often determine whether they collapse or thrive. To be resilient after failures, we have to learn from them. Most of the time we know this, we just don't do it. We're too insecure to admit mistakes to ourselves, or too proud to admit them to others. Instead of opening up, we get defensive and shut down. A resilient organization helps people overcome these reactions by creating a culture that encourages individuals to acknowledge their missteps and regrets. Recently, a chalkboard was put up in the middle of New York City. Write your biggest regret. Of the hundreds of answers, most had one thing in common. The majority of regrets were about failures to act, not actions that failed. Psychologists have found that over time, we usually regret the chances we missed, not the chances we took. As my mom often told me when I was growing up, you regret the things you don't do, not the things you do. At Facebook, we recognize that to encourage people to take risks, we have to embrace and learn from failure. When I joined the company, we had posters all over the walls that read, move fast and break things. And we meant it. In 2008, a summer intern named Ben Moorer was trying to stop our site from crashing. Hoping to debug the problem, he decided to trigger the failure himself and accidentally brought Facebook down.